This is Morning Edition Extra. I'm Jill Kaufman, and these were some of the voices in the news this week.
This is a very unique individual that doesn't have somebody that could step into her shoes to do this, the same sort of research she did and the same type of outreach she did. How would you replace somebody like that? You can't.
Even the school kitchens have been converted to just be warm-up facilities, so they can't do a full range of cooking options in most of the school kitchens here because it's all turned to reheating pre-processed, pre-cooked food that just comes in and gets heated up and served.
What we're doing is bringing them closer to their home community because these are all going to be Western Massachusetts women, so that we can enable them to re-enter their community in a safe and secure way.
That's Larry LaJoy, Assistant Superintendent of the Hampden County Sheriff's Department, detailing a 56-cell expansion of the Western Massachusetts Regional Women's Correctional Center in Chicopee. Before that, we heard Laura Porter from the Holyoke Food and Fitness Policy Council, which has been working to improve nutrition in school kitchens that serve underprivileged communities. Recent data show that obesity rates in children are declining in Massachusetts, but the rate is slower among low-income children. And at the start, we heard from Celeste Ossikainen, who was the lab assistant for more than a decade for Lynn Margulis, the renowned UMass Amherst geoscientist whose interdisciplinary program was shut down this week following Margulis' death earlier this year. Also this week, almost a year after tornadoes ripped through Springfield, local officials and others presented an action plan for redeveloping the city. This is Kevin Sweeney from the group Develop Springfield.
Part of the challenge is making sure that there's an integrated view as we think about all of those bundles of resources.
Those bundles of resources include people, insurance, money, federal and state emergency aid, and private investments. Though already developed Springfield's vision for the city exceeds available funding, the report does recommend federal appropriations could meet the city's needs. Thousands of residents worked on this document alongside city officials. It attempts to address both the physical rebuilding of neighborhoods and the deeper, maybe harder to change issues Springfield has been struggling with for years. Those include the public education system. Sweeney says a good example of developed Springfield can be seen in the schools so heavily damaged by the storm, they have to be rebuilt.
As we look at the sort of raw work of putting the walls back up for a school, are we thinking about the use of whether it's technology, new teaching methods and approaches, more community-based orientation, tie-in with public libraries, a host of possibilities that typically just don't present themselves in a normal school building exercise. Those all present themselves now, and then this is, I think, viewed as a way to say if you put all of these things together and they work in a single school, they become a model for approaches, strategies that you might employ or deploy elsewhere in the city.
Other cities have had great renovation. I think of Providence. I think of neighborhoods of Boston, Boston itself. Both of those are capital cities. Are you using any cities as models?
In the plan, there's actually there are precedents for almost every one of the recommendations in the plan. So, you know, cities from New Orleans to much smaller cities, cities that are similarly situated to Springfield in terms of size and region, are all have model programs. Providence is mentioned in some parts around culture and in other areas of the plan. So we've taken in the plan specific examples of what has worked and where there are real best practices, and said, here's some models we can look at. It's not that you take those in whole cloth and say they work in Springfield, but they became the basis in many instances for the brainstorming amongst the community members, the 3,000 people who were involved in the plan, to develop some of the most important action items that are identified in the plans.
Buy-in from the major players is key and from the stakeholders, but so is leadership. You've got yourself, you will not be the executive director of this project beyond the fall, as I understand it, but also we will have an election somewhere in there. The mayor Sonner may not be there in, you know, within 8 years. So how does a changing leadership affect this as well?
A lot of the heavy lifting, I think, in terms of getting to the point that we can identify clear milestones, clear projects where there's been community buy-in, it's going to have to happen in the next 2 to 3 years by definition, and a lot of the plan contemplates that. So It doesn't mean that every activity will be in full implementation mode, but I think, you know, 6 months out, we should be able to point to milestones that are happening or will happen within a year, and we should know what's going to happen 2 to 3 years out. So Kevin Kennedy is the chief development officer for the city of Springfield, and he is absolutely committed to moving things forward and has a track record of success both with the city of Springfield and in Congressman Neal's office making things happen. So
what is the thing that's going to make this different than other efforts to revitalize Springfield?
I think there's too many people in the city who are invested in this plan for it not to happen. I mean, that's different from other planning efforts in the past. I think the mayor and others and the folks who were involved, they did an extraordinary job of reaching out to people. And then once they reached out, people weren't going to let them not reach out. And I think that's going to be what holds us together.
That's Kevin Sweeney, Executive Director of Develop Springfield. The plan Kevin Sweeney spoke about can be found a bit later this morning at nepr.net. Imagine for a moment what it's like to stand before an audience and to belt out a song. Now picture the same thing in front of a crowd that's attentive and ready to give you some constructive feedback. That's what was happening for years at an open mic held at the Yellow Sofa, a cafe in Northampton, Massachusetts. The sofa closed a few months ago. Since then, area musicians have been trying to find a new venue, Nancy Cohen reports.
66-year-old Scott Cadwallader is a songwriter and guitar player who used to get feedback on his material mostly by posting it on YouTube. Songs like this one.
Someone has got to take the wheel. Someone with nerves made of steel. Obstacles in the way. Change the course, we've gone astray.
But Cadwallader yearned to connect with a live audience. So one night, a couple of years ago, he showed up at the Yellow Sofa and put his name in a jar, along with other musicians.
My name came up first on the list. I had never done this before, and it was, like, terrifying.
But the terror didn't last long.
After a while, you got used to it because there were other people who were doing the same thing, and so you could support other people and they could support you, and it was really nice.
There's this bond that's almost indescribable.
That's Laura Titrude, a 24-year-old UMass speech pathology grad student who also plays keyboard and writes songs.
When a new song kind of takes life of its own, you know, it's just this feeling of people coming together to create this thing that wasn't there before, and like anyone can understand it or be moved by it or be a part of it.
Besides playing on stage, the musicians get together to work on songs off stage.
All right. Well, that's a start.
That's Michael Silverstone and Felix Harvey trying out a new song Silverstone wrote.
It encourages me to go back and figure out how I would finish it. But what do you think about, you know, like what sorts of breaks would make it a, you know, satisfying song? And
I really like that minor. That D sharp minor thing.
Felix Harvey, who is a civil engineer, says in addition to the music, there's also a kind of philosophy that holds the group together.
Respectful, appreciative, listening environment. In fact, that's the way I describe it to many people. It's very listening, if that makes any sense. People get the message, you know, it's important to listen.
The message was reinforced by Michael Silverstone, who emceed the open mics. He brought a sensibility from his second grade classroom, where he teaches in Amherst, that everyone is worthy.
Every time somebody would get up on stage, I'd go, what is it that I love about this person's work? What's unique about it? What's great about it? How can I let the audience know that they're about to see something really special and that needs to be protected, you know, by attention? Because I wanted it for everybody, and I wanted it for myself.
But this winter, the Yellow Sofa Cafe went out of business, and it looked like this cozy incubator was about to fall apart. Scott Cadwallader.
The whole connection that I had with people at the sofa, the whole experience was just ripped away and gone. And so I was pretty devastated.
But then the former owner of the Yellow Sofa gave the actual sofa to Michael Silverstone. That spurred him to look forward. Six of the musicians held a meeting last month and decided to establish a kind of traveling Yellow Sofa open mic. The idea is to get invited to play at different venues. Their first gig was last Saturday at the Francis Crowe Community Room in Northampton. They brought the sofa with them.
This was really cool. It's kind of like a family reunion or something. Like, we didn't think we would ever be together again in our own place. And here we are in a different place. It's cool. All right.
Unlike the old venue, this room doesn't have a big window on Main Street to lure people in, or the occasional burst of air from a latte machine interrupting a song. But the spirit is still palpable.
Morning wind. Pick up your money and pack up your tent.
Silverstone says musicians need a place to be bad before they're good. And he says when an audience gives performers close attention, they grow. For New England Public Radio, I'm Nancy Cohen.
Should we attempt a cappella?
The next Yellow Sofa open mic is tomorrow night in Northampton. You can find more information at NEPR.net.
Gonna fly down in the easy chair. Right. Play ball.
This is Morning Edition Extra. I'm Jill Kaufman.
We should educate for change, not for the jobs of yesterday.
That's Hampshire College's president, Jonathan Lash.
70% of today's students will likely end up in jobs not yet invented. They will struggle to solve problems not yet understood, collaborating with people on multiple continents through institutions not yet created. Preparation to succeed and contribute in this connected, often confusing world requires education that provides more than narrow job training. Such rapid change demands adaptive intelligence that thrives on change. More than ever before, students will need to know how to think, evaluate, and explore, even as what they think about may change and expand. They will need the creativity and courage to challenge old ways of doing and working and to forge new paths and alliances. The boundaries of traditional academic disciplines no longer map onto the topography of today's pressing problems. Climate change, income inequality, providing more and healthier food to a growing global population, these issues demand collaborative, cross-disciplinary responses. In a global marketplace, students will need to engage varied perspectives and forge an ethical stance sensitive to cultural difference, guided by principles of fairness, justice, and intergenerational equity. 21st century citizens need to understand and assess scientific information that affects every facet of life, our food, health, work, mobility, and communication. And the way we relate to information is changing. There's much more. It is more accessible. It is unfiltered. And it changes rapidly, leaving the individual to sort through and make sense of it all. I disagree with those who advocate shifting the focus of undergraduate education to pre-professional training. Emphasizing marketability over creativity runs contrary to the demands of tomorrow's economy. In one recent survey, global business leaders overwhelmingly ranked creativity over technical expertise as the most important factor for future success. What one needs to know is subject to a rapidly changing world, but the how and the why, the core skills needed to acquire, evaluate, and add to knowledge, become the basis for creative engagement with the world. Graduates trained to adapt to new conditions with ingenuity, entrepreneurship, and capacity to mobilize collaborative thinking and action are the most valuable contribution higher education can make to society.
That's commentator Jonathan Lash. Lash will be inaugurated today as the new president of Hampshire College. His friend, former Vice President Al Gore, will be there too. The other morning, a group of ecologists and New England Public Radio producer Leanna First Arai paddled on over to an island in the Connecticut River near Northampton. The goal? Restore the floodplain forests by replanting American elms. Now, a non-native beetle introduced Dutch elm disease to American elm populations in the 1930s, and since then, the health of floodplain forests along the Connecticut has seriously declined. Once on the island, Kim Lutz and Christian Marks from the Nature Conservancy started the work this week by planting six different disease-resistant varieties of the tree.
A little further, Kim, and we'll head across.
Elm were the major tree in the floodplain forest, and they were pretty much wiped out by Dutch elm disease. So the goal is to restore enough locations along the whole river that they'll start to naturally reproduce and then spread their seed down the river, so we won't have to physically plant them, but the seed will just be there. The key will be to plant them in the right places where they can really thrive and to plant them in close proximity to other good habitats.
To go for it, we're doing two species. There's American elm and silver maple that we're putting in between so that the elms don't produce root grafts, because the disease can pass through the root grafts. See this pattern here of dark brown and whitish bark and alternating layers? That's how you can tell it's American elm. No other native tree has that.
In total, the Nature Conservancy's Connecticut River Program will plant 500 American elms along the river this year. This is Morning Edition Extra from New England Public Radio News. I'm Jill Kaufman. Have a good weekend.